This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to revisit a fascinating subject. Which is the ketogenic diet. There's a lot of buzz about ketogenic diet in the diet community, in the integrative community, both as a tool for weight loss and dealing with metabolic disorders, but on an even more profound level, as a potential treatment for cancer. And that's the focus of the book we're going to talk about today. It's called Keto for Cancer. And it's written by today's guest, who is Miriam Kalamian. And Miriam is a nutrition consultant, educator, and author specializing in the implementation of ketogenic therapies. That's her mission, getting the word out about ketogenic diet. She earned a Master of Education degree from Smith College. She has a Master of Human Nutrition from Eastern Michigan University, and she is board certified in nutrition. She has a CNS from the Board for Certification of Nutrition Specialists, and she has been personally involved on behalf of a family member with the ketogenic diet. We'll share that story with you in just a few moments. And also, she has worked closely with and has been highly lauded by her mentor, Dr. Thomas Seyfried, who's been a guest here on this program, who has written a book about the metabolic approach to cancer, which is a very, very detailed discussion of how cancer is a metabolic disease. It's a disease which has to do with disordered metabolism of cancer cells, and hence there may be a nutritional approach to dealing with cancer. So without further ado, here's our guest, Miriam Kalamian. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine, Miriam.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. This is such an important topic. I really want to get the word out about it.
Indeed. And so, well, first of all, share with us, because there's a personal story behind this, how you became such an advocate for the ketogenic diet.
Well, that's precisely it. I was advocating for my young son. He was 4 years old when we learned he had a brain tumor. And it was a devastating diagnosis, and the treatment protocol failed, and the backup treatment protocols failed.
Mm-hmm. And which, by the way, just very heavy-duty chemotherapy, surgery, and he was devastated by the side effects, and there wasn't much hope held out for him, correct?
No, he failed the 14 months of weekly chemotherapy. His tumor grew right through it. Mm-hmm. We opted then for a surgery that only one doctor in the country would even approach. It was actually multiple surgeries to try to remove as much of the tumor as possible. Mm-hmm. And it did a lot of damage. It may have slowed things down a little bit, but one section grew back immediately, plus 25% in just 8 weeks. So at that point, all they were offering was palliative chemotherapy, four different chemo drugs that would have kept him hospitalized and receiving transfusions. And it would have been terrible quality of life for what little time we had left. There was no hope for a cure here. This was a tumor the size of an orange in a little boy's mm-hmm. head.
Was this a glioblastoma multiforme, or was it a different form of brain cancer?
It was not a glioblastoma. It was officially, back in 2004, they didn't have all the genetic extras that they have now. Mm-hmm. So they just looked at it and said, oh, yeah, it's a low-grade glioma, juvenile pilocytic astrocytoma. Mm-hmm. But it covered a huge amount of the brain, and it was in very sensitive locations like the hypothalamus and the optic chiasm, which control, that's responsible for your vision, in the thalamus, responsible for speech and executive motor functionings, and it was just a devastating diagnosis with a relatively poor prognosis. And so we had exhausted the conventional route and were going to be moved to palliative care, and I was not looking for a diet. I was investigating a drug that he was on and that had the potential to damage his kidneys, and I had bookmarked a site, and when I went back to it a few days later, the information about the drug was gone, and Dr. Seyfried's research, the paper on the calorically restricted ketogenic diet, slowing progression of cancer in a mouse model of glioblastoma. So yes, it was a mouse model, but in the paper, that I was reading, there was a mention of a study in, just a brief mention, a study in children, with two children. So, of course, I had to contact him. Mm-hmm. I had to know more.
Yeah.
And he was extremely forthcoming with all the information that he had. And, boy, when I looked it over and my husband looked it over and we did the best job we could with just the mere speculation that was out there, and we thought, what have we got to lose? They've been using this diet for kids since the 1920s and compromised kids with epilepsy. And yes, our son was pretty compromised, but if they could do it, why couldn't we at least give it a try?
Well, so that's interesting that you mentioned that there's a historical precedent for this diet. Can you take us back to the use of the early use of ketogenic diet and why it seemed to help in seizure disorders? And to this day, I think it is being used. It's a sort of pain in the butt diet to follow. It's a very rigorous diet, but for kids who have no other recourse or not controlled by medication, I think it is sometimes an option, and it helps to control seizures. So what's going on there?
Well, back in the 1920s, I'll focus on the epilepsy part, and that was Russell Wilder at the Mayo Clinic. And he knew that ketones were in the urine of children who fasted, and these children who fasted quite often, they knew this about fasting, that it could resolve epilepsy. But you can't keep a child, you can't keep anybody in a continuously fasted state. But what he came up with was what he termed a ketogenic diet. So it made these ketone bodies that could be used as an energy source for the brain. So you could get the same
instead of sugar. In other words, the brain subsists on sugar. A lot of people believe that without eating sugar you'll die. But obviously that's not the case. I mean, if people say, I need my sugar fix because I'm feeling brain dead. You know, that term is in common parlance these days. But actually, your brain switches to ketones as fuel if you don't eat for many hours, if you fast, or if your diet is extremely low in carbohydrates, you're burning up ketones. It's a fuel for your brain.
Right. Your body makes that switch because if you think of it in evolutionary terms, if we missed a meal, which I'm sure we missed many meals, then where were you going to get your glucose? So first you access it through glycogen storage in the liver. But after you ran out of that, where were you going to get your glucose? And your mind had to be sharp, because if minds weren't sharp, then you couldn't hunt or you couldn't find the food that you needed. So this whole thing of needing to have a continuous supply of carbohydrates, so that when your glucose drops, then you need to feed more glucose. It's a construct that really doesn't apply to how we live our lives, in the last several thousand years. We haven't lived our lives apart from this food supply. So when you make that commitment to cutting out the carbohydrates, basically, your liver takes over the job of providing the glucose that your body needs. And there are some, you know, red blood cells need glucose. And there is about 30% of brain tissue that remains reliant on glucose. So ketones can cover up to 70%, but there is this portion that needs the glucose. But your liver can do this, and it does it quite nicely by recycling one of the byproducts of oxidizing fats, of burning fats. It can take in the liver, glycerol is converted back into glucose, and that supplies all the glucose you need. The ketones are covering the brain, the fatty acid oxidation, whether it's coming from dietary sources or coming from fat stores, is supplying the bulk of the energy needed for muscle and heart tissue. So we're pretty well, you know, adapted. We don't need to have dietary carbohydrate. Hard thing for people to understand. That, and then the other part of that is that we don't need to have as much fat in the diet if we're overweight. So people think they have to stuff themselves with fat to maintain a ketogenic diet, but you don't need to do that if you're overweight. You can allow that accessing of your fat stores to provide quite a bit of the fatty acids.
Mm-hmm. So you're literally burning down your adipose tissue and using that for fuel, which is desirable when you're dieting. And I think you may interrupt that process if you have frequent snacks that contain carbohydrates, because your body never quite gets into a fat-burning mode.
Right. It doesn't adapt as well.
Yeah. So let's focus on cancer, because that's the thrust of the book. We'll talk a little bit about some other applications of the ketogenic diet, because it's not strictly for cancer. There are many potential benefits to ketogenic diets. But when it comes to cancer, you know, look, this is very complicated, and Dr. Seyfried has written a huge tome on the subject, Metabolic Approach to Cancer,
yes.
And you, in your book, have boiled it down in as simple terms as I've ever seen, but it's still a sophisticated concept that people want to learn more. They can do a deep dive in your book, which, by the way, is just out this week. It's just been released. Is that correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So in a nutshell, what's the theory? Why should cancer be halted or inhibited by a ketogenic diet?
Okay, there's the simple view of it, which has to do with the fact that cancers use a lot of glucose. That's very evident. Everybody knows this in the cancer research and in the cancer in oncology world. They know this, and that's why people get things like PET scans.
Mm-hmm.
PET scans use what's called the glucose analog. So it's a form of glucose that can't really be metabolized, but it's taken up by cells that are really glucose hungry. So those hot spots that you see on a PET scan are actually areas that are very metabolically active and utilizing glucose. And one of the things that happens with that heavy utilization of glucose is you make a lot of waste product within the cell, and that waste product is lactic acid. Same as if you were, you know, sprinting and you're going to use, you know, your muscle glycogen, you're going to use muscle glucose to power that sprint, you're going to create lactic acid. So that lactic acid, our cells, when we make a little bit of it, they can handle it, but when we make excessive amounts of it, then it's toxic and it needs to be removed from the cell. It increases the acidity of that area around the cell, and in doing so, inflammation and cancer go hand in hand. So it's really kind of a cancer promoter. So if you can cut down on the supply, you can't cut it off.
Mm-hmm.
You can't literally starve your tumor of glucose, because, like I said, your body's going to make some glucose.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't cut it off entirely, but you can bring that level down, and you can create less waste and less of the materials that cancer needs to grow, less of the stimulation to grow. So it's not just about starving the cancer of glucose. So, and I go into that in my book. It's like, okay, this is the simple thing. Now, if you want to take it a step further, look at the level of nutrient sensing. So if your cells are thinking they're being deprived, then they're going to change how they behave. And one of the ways they change how they behave is to slow down on the activities that result in proliferation of cancer, kind of slow that down. We don't have any extra for growth right now. And then the other thing that happens with the nutrient sensing is, okay, well, we're going to direct the nutrients that we do have to the healthy mitochondria. And in doing that, that compromises the cells that are the mitochondria that are dysfunctional and sensitizes them to these other treatments. So it slows proliferation, sensitizes them to other treatments. And whether those are conventional, you know, radiation or chemotherapy, or whether there are alternative treatments, these compromise it. And when these cells are compromised, they're more likely to self-identify as being damaged, and that's where that programmed self-suicide can kick back in. We lose it in cancer, but we can kick it back in by making these changes in our diet. And then those cells get cleared out. That internal housekeeping will clear them out. So it's not a cure, and it's not a standalone therapy. But I'm convinced that if you combine a ketogenic diet with other therapies, you will have slowed progression in many cancers, maybe not all, and you'll have better quality of life. And that's huge in a cancer, especially something like brain cancer. It's a terrible prognosis, and it's a generally a pretty poor quality of life in that short period of time that you have. So I know for our son, we got 6 years from the time that we started him on the diet, and in that 6 years, our little guy was able to live his life. We did things. He did mm-hmm. what he loved. And we had this 6 years with him that was not spent in hospitals.
Hmm.
It wasn't spent in
his prognosis at the time you initiated the diet was, you know, virtually weeks or months.
I can't say it would have been weeks or months for him. The prognosis was basically 5 years. It's X number of kids make it 5 years, but according to the characteristics of our son's tumor, size, location, time it took to diagnose, all of those kinds of things, that it spanned so much of the brain, that it was in these delicate locations, mm-hmm. I don't think he would have made 5 years. So at the time they were starting him on palliative, they were looking on the outside at about being able to control it for at most, like there was a 1 in 10 chance that they could control it for 18 months.
Mm-hmm. It's really fortuitous that your book is coming out this week, because this story has made headlines in some of the major media. I'm reading here from USA Today. Relationship between sugar and cancer is now clearer, scientists say. It's a research breakthrough. And Belgian scientists say they've made a research. This is at the University of Leuven in Belgium. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Based on the study of yeast, they actually documented the specific pathways, some of which you described, which suggests that cancer growth is facilitated by carbohydrates. Again, it's simplistic to say, you know, sugar feeds cancer, take away the sugar and the cancer can't grow. We're not talking about that, because right. the message is, as you stated, it's more subtle than that and more complicated. But these researchers started researching sugar's links to cancer in 2008, and they are referring back to a guy named Otto Warburg, who
right.
about a century ago did breakthrough mm-hmm. research that shows that there is a correlation between the strength of the Warburg effect and tumor aggressiveness. So they say,
right.
quote, this link between sugar and cancer has sweeping consequences. Our results provide a foundation for future research in this domain. They stop short of recommending a ketogenic diet, but
right.
they're pointing in that direction.
They still think that cancer is a genetic disease. They're still looking at it through that genetics filter Yes, there are gene mutations, but are they the cause or the effect of this mitochondrial dysfunction? And where's this mitochondrial dysfunction? You know, why are we having these issues? Why is this so much more prevalent? And I would say that it's not genetics that's driving it, or we wouldn't see such a steep rise in not just in cancer, but in obesity and in diabetes. Look at diabetes, mm-hmm. how it's, you know, that wave's rolling right over the top of us. It wasn't the change in our genetic structure over the last century. It's just a difference in what we're eating. And I would argue that it's primarily based on the overload of sugar that's in our diet.
You know, just as in a heart disease, the epidemiology researchers pointed to fat consumption as the culprit. You know, too much fat causes heart disease, it clogs your arteries, and too much fat ultimately results in cancer. But it turns out that if you really examine the literature, much of it is questionable. That, you know, if you look at when people consume saturated fats that aren't full of environmental pollutants, that are grass-fed or organically raised, that's not really the driving force behind heart disease or cancer, and that most studies suggest that excess carbohydrates are behind both diseases.
It makes me crazy in the research to read a paper that says high-fat diet does all these terrible things. That they use a genetically modified mouse model, okay, and this mouse becomes obese, diabetic in a matter of 8 weeks when fed a high-fat diet. Well, what they mean by a high-fat diet is just slightly higher mm-hmm. than what is, you know, in our nutritional guidelines. It's 45% fat. So if they're getting 45% fat and they're getting a decent amount of protein, the rest of this is coming from sugars. So this high-fat diet that they're talking about, when you don't see ketogenic and you see high-fat, 45%
fat. It's not a very low-carb diet.
No, it's 30% carb, and that's usually 15% sucrose, which would be table sugar, and 15% as a starch. Just to give an example, like tapioca starch, a gluten-free flour like tapioca starch, it's all glucose.
Okay, well,
so it's that combination.
Indeed. I mean, if you add a lot of fat to a base of, you know, a caloric carbohydrate diet, yeah, you're going to promote obesity, but
inflammation. Inflammation
and drive the cellular machinery towards the mutations that may lead to cancer.
Exactly.
Good point at which to pause, because we divide our podcast into two parts. We've laid the groundwork for a discussion of the ketogenic diet for cancer. We'll examine some more of the evidence. We'll talk about the practicalities, because this is a challenging diet to follow. We're talking to Miriam Kalamian, author of Keto for Cancer, just out this week, and she is a staunch advocate for ketogenic diets. Her book beautifully describes how you can implement a ketogenic diet safely and practically, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.